Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can learn more about Author at authormagazine.org, and we're funded by the one and only Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA and their Writers Conference, it's our 60th anniversary this summer. You can go to PNWA.org and learn about our Writers Conference. If you want to learn how to connect with other agents and editors, other writers, if you're an indie writer, maybe you want to learn how to better connect with your readers, you could do no better than the PNWA Summer Writers Conference. Well, writing is, can be, an uncertain endeavor. You don't know what's going to happen to a book when you write it. You don't know who's going to publish it, who's going to like it. In fact, really, you don't know what you're going to get every day when you go to that blank page. You just don't know. As Lisa Gardner said when we interviewed her, the writer's job is to become comfortable with being uncomfortable. But I do believe that if we can keep the arrow of our attention trained on what makes us happy as writers, as people, can keep it trained on what brings us joy, well, we can do a lot to take some of that uncertainty out, which is why I'm so glad to have the guest I have on the show today, Dr. Roger Thiel, who has written a book called This Life is Joy, Discovering the Spiritual Laws to Live More Powerfully, Lovingly, and Happily. If I tried to give you Dr. Thiel's full bio, I would never have time to get him on, but I will say that he is the senior minister and spiritual director of the Mile High Church, which in addition to its serving its 10,000 members, has also hosted a variety of renowned speakers. Reads like a who's who list of the spiritual speakers and thinkers today, like Wayne Dyer, Deepak Chopra, Reverend Michael Bernard Beckwith, and Barbara Marx Hubbard. He's also has acted as the chairman of the International Board of Trustees for Centers for Spiritual Living. He's also served on the boards of the Interfaith Alliance of Colorado, the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, the Foundation for Affordable Housing, and the Community First Foundation. Oh, my God, and there's still more, but I don't have time for it because I want to talk to him. Roger, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bill. Delighted to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you on, and unless I've missed something, This Life is Joy is your first book. Is that true, or have I simply skipped something in all the publicity information that's been sent to me?
No, you're correct that this is my first book. I've been writing all my career, you know, but this
sure.
is the first published book, yes.
Yes, you've been writing. Of course, you're a minister, and so you've got to compose in some form or another your sermons, which how often do you do? Do you do once a week, or how often do you do it?
I do that, yeah, about 36 of the 52 Sundays a year.
All right.
I'm holding forth.
And so how did some ministers, from what I know, my dad was one once way back when, and I believe he wrote his out ahead of time, I think. Would you write yours out, or do you have kind of a loose outline and allow yourself to sort of improvise?
It's a real loose outline. I like, you know, just the energy of the people and the inspiration of the moment really serves. But, you know, in writing the book, it was a different endeavor, and I didn't just collect a bunch of old messages and try to weave them together. This was pure new writing, although, of course, some of the ideas that I presented were similar, but it was new writing, and I really enjoyed that process.
Well, so, but why do it, Roger? You're a busy man. You've got a lot going on. You've got a lot of people you're helping. You're obviously thriving. You're doing the thing you love. What you know, and I ask that question honestly because I'm always interested. It is so interesting to me how things start, because the creative process is so mysterious. And so how did this one start? What told you needed to do this?
You know, I think it evolved over the years. My wife tells me that 27 years ago when we were first dating, I spoke of writing a book. So, as you know, it took me a while to get around to it. And It was mostly because I knew that it would be a good way to share ideas with the world, to not just be a local person serving in a local way, but perhaps to step out into a more global or at least an extended purview. So that I sort of held it. But, you know, I think there comes a time when it's really right. And and quite frankly, if I'd known all of the many demands on 2013, which is the year I wrote it, I probably would have procrastinated even more. And it was an extraordinarily busy and demanding year. And yet I'd signed a contract with Torture Penguin to write it. And so I had to do it. And, you know, sometimes that necessity is a writer's best friend.
Yes, it is. It's true. I've known many writers who feel they need hours of leisurely time to be able to write effectively. And then when they're suddenly given this deadline, they're amazed what the imagination provides for them in a moment of need.
Yeah, that's right. We tell stories to ourselves that we need space and we need peace and quiet in our lives and no distractions. And quite frankly, sometimes we have to access the muse even amidst all the other demands. And sometimes I wonder if it doesn't even turn out better then.
The muse does not care how busy you are. He, she, it is there all the time. It's just a question of whether you... That's been my experience anyway. Just a question of whether you turn.
That's right.
All right, so... I want to write a book. You're a man. You want to help people. You've always had a spiritual relationship to your life. Obviously, you're someone who loves to communicate. But when you write a book, you can't just write a book. You have to choose a focus for it. And so When did you decide you wanted to write a book? I don't know if you had the title first or not, but giving with this particular focus.
Well, I committed to the book before I knew the focus. But I did have a sense that it was timely, that now really was the time. And then I just put it into the universe, as it were. I just said, okay, I'm going to know how to lens the various ideas that I have been growing with myself and have been sharing, that the right format's going to be there. And actually, it was in a very, very long, a 4-hour meditation session, you know, at an event that I was at, where the first chapter just floated into my awareness, this instant is love. And it was so powerful, the vibration of it, that it compelled me. And I could just sort of sense the power and the meaning of it. I didn't think it up as much as it emerged. And then some of the other chapters during that session began to show up as well. And then doing a little bit of journaling after it, all of the chapters just fell into place from that place.
I love that story. I love talking to particularly novelists who often don't see themselves as particularly spiritual people. They're just trying to tell stories, you know, because they got to make a living. But once you push them a little bit, because that's what I do, and I do love the relationship to the creative part of ourselves, they speak about their own work, whether they're writing suspense novels or romances or literary novels or poetry, exactly the same way you just spoke about your book, which is it comes to them, it seemed real, they weren't going to question it, they trusted it, they followed it. It all comes from the same place. It just gets, it seems to me, it just gets translated into different forms. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure does. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yep. So I'm going to play... These same people I just spoke about, a lot of times when I talk to them about spiritual questions, the common response is this. This life is joy. Oh, really? Have you looked around? Have you looked around at Afghanistan? Have you looked around at ISIS? And then the list goes on all the way back to Genghis Khan and, you know, Caesar, if you want. This is I hear this response again and again and again. How do you respond to that? Because I'm sure that has come your way at some point in your teaching.
Yes, and I anticipated it when that title was selected. And by the way, my publisher really rooted to have that title. It was one of the chapters, and he said, I think that really is compelling, and people will want to discover the rest of it through that chapter. But what I suggest is there's a difference between the pain-pleasure syndrome that most humans are enrolled in, that there's a deep joy, which is the very core of life. And I believe that deep joy is also the very core of you and me. And I think that a lot of our own pain and suffering and challenges in our life is brought about because we have been distanced from our joy. the kind of aliveness and joy and vibrancy and creativity that is a real natural power in us. And when we lose track of that, we start turning to other things. We start turning to desired outcomes to give us a rush and to give us that temporary pleasure. And so we try to maintain temporary pleasures of superficial happiness, and when we can't manipulate that into place, then we usually find ourselves in the experience of its opposite, which is pain. And then the only recourse, if we can't manipulate a new pleasure high, is to find ways to numb the pain. And so we have that kind of a process going on in our society of pleasure, pain, and numbing, and the addictive process running rampant. And I believe that we're distanced from our true power, which is the very joy of being itself. And I think that it's powerful to reconnect with that because it gives us the strength to carry on. I'm talking about a kind of joy here, Bill, that can carry us through the painful times and give some thought to the possibility that you can have a deep joy within you even when you're grieving the natural loss of a loved one or a pet or the loss of a career or a job or whatever the case may be, that you can be still buoyed by a deep joy that gives you a sense of hope. You know that the conditions that feel painful will pass, especially, and they'll pass more elegantly and quickly as you maintain that deep connection to life itself that births this kind of joy. This is the kind of joy that I'm speaking of here. And I believe that the world would be a better place if human beings could reconnect with it.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. But Bill,
no,
I
go
find
ahead.
That truly, deeply, authentically joyous people don't start wars. Joyous, deeply authentic
no.
people don't lash out at others. They don't try to bring others down. They don't create bridges of separation. Truly joyous people are the creative ones. They're the bridge builders. They're the ones with the open hearts. So, see, I'm talking about this joy, this deep, profound joy, as being the access point to all the best there is in human beings.
Yeah, it's unconditional joy. It's unconditional contentment. Yeah, you only fight a war because you think, I need those people to be dead for me to be happy. I want to be happy, but they have to be dead first. And so they do this.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, and what I love about the title is, and this for me has been important in my life and certain kinds of understandings that have made a big difference in how I've lived, is it is easier to access the joy that you're speaking of, in my experience, if you first have an understanding that it is, that you believe it is always available, even when you can't see it. You have to first, because I remember talking to a friend who said to me, well, Bill, happiness isn't normal. It just happens occasionally and you're lucky. And I said, well, if you live that way, you're so rarely ever going to be happy. But if you believe it's normal, you will always be looking for it, even when you can't see it. Right?
Yeah. But I think that's the sad thing in our society is that we haven't cultivated a collective sense of deep joy. And so we turn to consumerism, materialism, and other isms to try to create this substitute for something that's deeply within us. And we're caught in this kind of trance of joylessness. And if you just look at the way nature celebrates itself, young things, whether they're children or pups or fawns or whatever the case may be, that they've got an uninhibited, unobstructed sense of joy. And what if that isn't just naivety and the province of the youngest, but what if it's the real authentic way we're designed to live, to be maximally powerful and creative in this life?
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm talking to you now, writers. Don't look to your rejection letters and your acceptance letters and your reviews on Amazon and what your critique group thinks of your work for your joy. Look to the creative process itself. It's all in there. And speaking of the creative process, Roger, you said something interesting in the beginning. You anticipated a question of mine, in fact, which is this. You came to this book with a lot of understanding about this subject, and yet you found more in the writing of it. So what did you uncover in the writing of this that you did not already know in all your teaching and coaching and ministering?
You know, I find that when one really yields to the creative flow in writing, that it's a spiritual experience. You may not, certain individuals may not choose to call it that, but for me it is. because it kind of puts you in the flow of that universal mind or that infinite intelligence. And by suspending, and what I tried to do was not, I didn't do a very intricate outline because in a way that could interfere with this flow. I had a direction for each chapter and a few ideas, but I didn't even know how they'd get woven in. And as I just started, then the path kind of unfolded through me. And so just the very experience of writing it was a powerful thing. And yet it seemed like almost every chapter I wrote, something profound, whether it was a nuance or a facet of something that I was somewhat aware of, but some new facet deepened me and grew me, which leaves me really kind of profoundly grateful for having chosen to finally get around to doing this. For instance, in the chapter, this disease is discovery. In that chapter, I knew I wanted to write about one of the things we face in this life. It's this body of ours, which is a three-dimensional, biodegradable spacesuit for the spirit or the soul. But it runs into trouble from time to time. It's not meant to go on forever. And so how do we deal with that? And I found that as writing it, that realizations began to surface that were very moving to me and helpful to me, as well as helpful to me when I help others. You know, that oftentimes we have to look at disease as a message. You know, that sometimes it's a message from the body saying, you know, your lifestyle is not supporting me. That's the body speaking to us. You know, how about a little more rest, or how about a change in the diet, or how about more water, or whatever the body might cry out for. We're not well trained to listen to the messages from the body, and it's an incredible temple that we have here. It's a wondrous thing. We tend to not listen to it. And then there's awareness messages. Sometimes illness is the body helping us realize we've got toxicity going on in our thinking, in our attitudes, that we've held on to bitterness or judgment for so darn long that the body's beginning to impact that. And, you know, the connection between mind and body is well established. And so sometimes the body's faltering is an awareness message. Take stock. Where have you been hanging out in your awareness? And then sometimes I believe it's also a soul message. It's that because we don't listen to our soul level any better than we do our bodies most of the time. And sometimes it's the soul getting a word in edgewise saying, you know, it's time to do what you really love, or it's time to open your heart, or, you know, all of the messages that the soul brings us. It's time to live in a greater state of awe, or it's time to embrace your true purpose and have the courage to go for it. And sometimes illness is actually the gifts of those kind of messages. And you know, I kind of knew those things theoretically, but as I wrote it, it became real and palpable and clear in a way it hadn't been for me.
Yeah. It's just great. I know that when I started dealing with any kind of illness, or, you know, my back was out or whatever, and started looking at it on it as information, and that's what I do now, it changed my relationship to my body dramatically. I'm actually probably healthier than I've ever been. In fact, I just had my first winter without a cold. First in 50 years. How about that? All right, so that was a good one.
Didn't buy into have to have flu? You didn't buy into that?
No. I forgot that it was winter and I was supposed to get a flu, and so I didn't. Isn't that great?
Good for you.
But I love this. And so you got to discover this in the writing, and you said something which I think is so important, for I hope our listeners heard it, which is that it the writing served you first. First, it served you.
Yeah.
It came and you benefited from it first. And I'll tell you, and it's almost at that point you don't need to share it, but of course you love it and so you want to share it. But I think that is, if there's not, I cannot think of a better way, a better relationship to have with the work I'm doing. That first it benefits you. First you grew from it.
It's
great, isn't it?
And I think, and you know, I would also offer that a couple of things helped me most. First of all, to do some meditating before I would write. Not only did all of the table of contents, which became the outline of the overall book, come to me out of meditation, but I would always get still. And whether you call it meditation or even feel like you're good at it, just be still and quiet the mind. And instead of diving into figuring out what to say, just be still. which kind of links us to something, to the, you could call it the muse or the greater intelligence or the field of awareness, and to write out of that. And the other thing that helped me a lot was another book by Stephen Pressfield, The War of Art. Are you familiar with that?
You know, I could tell you nothing about it, but I'm familiar with it in terms of,
well,
I know it's out.
The whole theme of this short book is resistance, and the resistance any and almost everybody will experience facing any project, whether it's writing or anything. And I would read a couple of pages of that every day, and that sort of kick-started me to get going.
Yeah, I have found to be, as I've deepened my mastery of it, and I use that word as humbly as I can, but I've been doing it for a long time, and I come to see it as a relationship to resistance and effortlessness that might, but to sense resistance and pull the effort past, the effort past, the effortless. That when I remember that's my job, quote unquote, it goes so much more smoothly. And it sounds like that's what you're talking about. Because you're going to meet resistance. You know, it's going to happen.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that leads me to actually something I very much wanted to talk to you about, which is chapter 6, This Journey is Surrender.
Uh-huh.
Surrender. Which seems to lead into that. So what does that mean? Because we're a bunch of winners here. And surrenders, those who have surrendered have lost. How is this journey, this life journey, surrender?
I love that chapter because I've been called a type A, very goal oriented and motivated, and that's good. And yet over the years, through my own life lessons, I've realized that I really access my greatest power through surrender, which is not like giving up or retreating. I'm talking about a kind of surrender that's yielding to something greater. It's flowing with something greater. It's tuning in. It's setting aside one's preconceptions and tuning into a greater wisdom and being available to it so that we can allow something higher than we might know to show up, whether it's in our writing or in any aspect of life. It's kind of acknowledging that there's this inspiration or this wisdom that we're a part of, this infinite intelligence that we're a part of. But we've got to kind of loosen our grip on what we think we know to be available to what's more than we know. And so it's a kind of non-resistance, too. It's letting go of our own certainties and our own expectations, which are often fear-based, and allowing ourselves to be guided, allowing ourselves to be inspired, allowing bigger ideas than we've yet even realized to come forth, and letting higher energies have their way with us. That's the kind of surrender that this is all about.
Yeah. Letting it happen. And, you know, every writer who's ever I've taught or spoken to speaks about the moment when they enter the zone, where they forget about time. It's kind of like a dream. They forget about time, they forget where they are, and they just enter this flow. And I think, and anything that happens in that flow is usually better than anything that comes out of that flow. And you can't enter that flow unless you surrender. You can't think you're in charge if you want to get into that flow. I can't. I've never done it. You got to let go of the shore.
Indeed.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, I've got someone.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I
also wrote that. I wrote that chapter also to encourage people to surrender old ideas about themselves and old ideas about their lives, because maybe a new chapter wants to be written.
Oh, excellent. Well, I have someone here who would like to ask you a question, I think, and I believe I know who it is. Jeffrey, is that you?
It is, Bill. Another exceptional interview. They just get better and better. Dr. Teal, you're very welcome. I'm definitely going to get out there and get your book right away, and congratulations.
Thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome. My question is, you've expressed that you experienced a mystical awareness of the oneness, expressed in all creation, a knowing that has stayed with you throughout your life. I'm a person that's forever aspiring to live a transcendentalist existence, you know, connected to the natural world. Would you please expand on oneness for me and the listeners?
Sure. I think it's the base it's the base idea, the basic, most foundational idea for, I think, not only my book, but for a spiritually activated life. And oneness is actually the reality of things. Even now, the mystics of old have taught us that basically this universe is woven together in a oneness, and that everything that is an expression of a universal life or universal power, a universal love. And so this oneness path is to awaken to that oneness. And it happens, I think, to all of us in a progressive way. I did have an unexpected initiatory kind of experience when I was six that I write about early in the book, where looking up at the sky, there was no more Roger for I don't even know what time it was, and I was one with the sky and the clouds and the sun, and I thought I'd died, actually. And I didn't understand it at the time and hid it away and was frightened by it. But something was downloaded into me, and something that didn't let me go was forged out of that spawned my spiritual search later on in my life. And at the time, and I grew to understand it a little more. But what I would encourage is that if you can sense that not only have the mystics taught us this, but even modern science, quantum physics, tells us that there's this universal field of that's characterized by energy and information, and every bit of matter merges out of this invisible reality, then the truth is we're already an expression of this oneness, this universal life and love. And so I think the quiet moments that we spend, or the awakened moments, whether it's awe with nature, rather than looking at things around us as just objects, we realize it's all life, it's all the oneness expressing itself. When we open our hearts and we feel our connection with another being at a deep level, and we realize that deeply we are one with this being. It looks like we've got separate bodies and a separate personality, but at the deepest level, we are actually one. Expressing from the same spirit, each of us in a unique way. I mean, if we could take these moments in our life and use them to go beyond the illusion of separation, that is another plague of humanity's struggles, and can come into this oneness, I think progressively we sense that we are a part of the all. And we do it in our prayer life, in our awakened moments, in our open hearts. In these ways, oneness can become more real. Does this support you, Jeffrey, in this?
Oh, I've put him on hold, but I will bring him back.
Okay.
Jeffrey, what do you think about that answer?
I think
does that help?
Very, very much so. I mean, everything he said resonated so much within me. And it's beautiful. Thank you, Dr. Jill. I will definitely, that will resonate. I feel myself absorbing it into my marrow. Very, very important. Your book, I hope everybody goes out and gets that book. These are things that I've been aspiring to hear and listen to and connect to, and I could not agree with more. Bill, thanks so much for taking my question.
Oh, you're very welcome. You know, I will say one of the things that has been very helpful to me around these kinds of questions is to say, do I want to live in a universe that is one? I mean, would I prefer to live in one where there's a kind of a unified consciousness? And so if I can't see it sometimes, you know, I look out the world and I see separation, I ask myself the question, but what if the world is one? Even though I'm seeing separation, and I do, what if that doesn't exist? What if it's not real? Then what am I actually seeing? This allows me a space to begin to answer that question. That acknowledges, because see it all. I can't see it all the time. I'm not the Buddha, you know.
Well, you know, and what we also have to acknowledge is that our sense of separation is not only furthered by our three senses that look out at the universe and see time, depth, and space, and separation between objects, but also our fear. What really furthers this is that we've fallen into fear-based lives, and it's out of our fear that we distance from the rest of creation, from other beings. And the truth actually is that it is all one. Even at the physical level, it looks like there's separation between objects. But if we could see it through the eyes of the molecular microscopes and other instruments, we'd realize it's all a dance of one life and intelligence. It's all more nearly light than it is separate particles. And so what we get to do is reawaken to these things and go beyond what we think is the obvious separation to the deep oneness. I believe that humanity and a lot of the problems we face are showing us the symptoms of our fear and sense of separation, and the only ultimate healing is to return to this oneness.
Excellent. Well, that is almost the perfect note on which to end our conversation, but I want to ask you one more question, Dr. Teal. Are you ready?
Sure.
You were born ready. Okay, this is a... I'd like you to finish the sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
It has taught me trust. It has taught me to trust that there's something powerful and wonderful that wants to express itself by means of me, and also to trust enough to get out of the way of that and let it express.
Good answer, Roger. Well, thank you so much. The book is This Life is Joy on sale everywhere. Are you going to be out traveling the world talking to people about it?
If invited, I'll go anywhere they want me to.
Excellent. Okay, well, best of luck, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Many blessings to you and to the audience.
Oh, thank you. Oh, trust everybody. Can't beat it. Okay, next week I'll be talking. Oh, I'm on a theme. I'm going to be talking to Wendy Thomas Russell, author of Relax, It's Just God, How and Why to Talk to Your Kids About Religion When You're Not Religious. Ah, well, trust. I encourage it. In the meantime, I want you all to go out and do something you love, be with someone you love, listen to a song you love. I don't care. Go wrong when you do.